The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager bringing you another edition of The Heretics Hour on this May 28th, 2012. Which happens to be Memorial Day night in the United States. But wait, there seems to be something different. Oh, yes, I'm broadcasting from a new place. It's the White Network I'm coming from tonight at www.thewhitenetwork.com. Most of you listening are familiar with this, I'm sure. But if there are any people who have somehow stumbled upon this broadcast without knowing the background of it, I will say that... This has been a short dream, but of several months since it was first conceived to create this network, and tonight it is a reality. And I just love the creative process. I've put a lot of time thinking about it. You know, you start with an idea always, and eventually, step by step, if you keep your commitment to it, it starts taking form until finally you have something that exists in the real world. And that's what we have tonight, thanks to the efforts of Tan Stoffel, who has put this all together. And I do believe he's created something that is one of a kind as it has taken shape. It's probably the only thing like it on the internet at this moment, not in all its forms, but in some of the specifics. And in case anybody needs to know, Tan Stoffel is the owner and operator of the blog at ageoftreason.blogspot.com, and you can go there if you haven't been there yet, and put a hyphen between age of and of treason when you do it. But you can also just Google it. And my website is carolynyeager.com, in case anybody doesn't know that. So that's where you can. Where we have all of our material stored and archived and so on. But tonight, Tan Stoffel is with me now, and we're going to spend this program, at least at the beginning of it, to give you an overview of what we've been doing and what we intend to do to expand your experience of white radio. So hi, Tan. How are you feeling tonight? Are you upbeat as I am?
Hi, Carolyn. Yeah, I'm really excited. Excited and exhausted. It's been an exhausting couple of weeks, these past few weeks, and I'm glad to finally go live with this project. And we can grow it from here.
I am too, and we have to tell the listeners that it might be a little bit slower in growing than they would like, and it's a little slower than I would like, but we have to make sure that, say, this program functions all right before we start adding on others. But we'll talk about our programming in a little while. Unless you have something that you want to say, Tan, to begin, I just thought we might start out with talking about why we think this network is a good idea, why we thought it was necessary, why we've done it.
Let me mention, just to tone back or be a little bit more humble, you were very, very courteous and flattering there in the way you described what I've done, but... mainly, I'm standing on the shoulders of other people, what other people have done, the pieces and parts. I just have sewn them together. And I put them together in a particular pattern based on what I had already seen in action at the Voice of Reason, where your show used to be hosted. And, you know, we owe them a debt there of providing an example of how it can work. And that was what inspired me. And whenever I got confused or faced a decision point about how something should work, if I didn't have a clear idea of my own, I just thought, well, how does Voice of Reason do it? And that's the pattern I followed. And they deserve credit for putting that together and doing a great job with that. Now, I hope to take it a little bit beyond what Voice of Reason has done. I know from being a guest and you from being a host that there are some limits to Voice of Reason, and we want to try and automate our production a bit so that things get published very quickly and all of that. But That a lot of those pieces aren't in place yet on this network, so maybe I'll talk about those in the future when they do exist.
Well, okay, then let's talk about why we think this network is necessary. Why didn't I just stay at Voice of Reason? And I hesitate to even bring up Voice of Reason because I don't want it to sound wrong. But one thing that we found was important right in the beginning as we were talking was the 14 words written by David Lane in the 1980s that are used by many people. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. So this is one of our guiding principles. It is about children, and we're going to put some focus on that, on the future of our white children.
Yeah, it's a principle around which the kind of people that think as we do should be able to rally. And people who can't rally around that, people who have a problem with that message, that very simple message, have a problem with us. And I think it's an irreconcilable problem. They have to accept that we are a people and that we want to continue. And we're going to do what it takes to continue. So get out of our way. Join us or get out of our way is the corollary.
Yeah, I think that's our message. We want our friends and supporters and those who think the way we do to take on this idea of the urgency and to say, let's start moving along here. We've been talking about things so long, and we keep kind of going backwards. I don't want to be pessimistic. I'm not pessimistic, but I think part of my feelings are that we have to speak out more forcefully. And so, why is the existence of our children in jeopardy? I mean, we've had some news just recently about the birth rate in the United States tipping over to where there's now more non-white births than white births. So this is very, very ominous, I would say. What do you say about that?
Well, I would say it is ominous, but it's really only ominous because of the competition that we face from other peoples who are replacing us. If the white birth rate was falling and the borders of the country were closed and the population of the country was going down, there wouldn't be any ominous threat to that unless we were approaching such a bottleneck in population size that it actually started to have some sort of genetic impact as far as the variability that's needed at the genetic level to maintain viable species. But the main problem is the fact that we have other people that are moving into our territory and are displacing us and are dispossessing us of our resources. They paint it as sharing in our resources or even contributing. This idea that immigration is actually somehow contributing to all of us becoming more wealthy. But it's a fallacy. It's really just taking from us and it's taking from our children. Our children's birthright is actually being handed to foreigners, aliens. And the other aspect of it is the financial fraud aspect that the current economy, as it's structured right now, is a pyramid scheme, essentially. It's based on the presumption of an ever-growing base of the pyramid, which means, in practical terms, that the population has to continually grow. And if it doesn't continually grow, well, then you get sort of a crisis of confidence in the whole system, and it begins to collapse or shows signs of collapsing. And that was the essential trigger for the bubble bursting, the real estate bubble bursting, was when it looked like immigration wasn't going to be expanded immediately, they realized, well, this real estate bubble isn't going to be able to continue to expand, and so it collapsed. And the entire economy is based on this idea of infinite growth, and it isn't going to work. And with a shrinking population, you often hear it discussed in terms of Japan, because Japan has the problem I wish we had, which is a dropping population, but they're not being flooded with aliens. So as a people, they're not really threatened yet, but economically they are threatened because their economy is tied to ours, at least indirectly, and is based on similar premises of infinite growth. And so they face a bit of a crisis there economically.
Okay, and that was good. Now, when we talk about, I was talking earlier about the efforts that we make and pro-white efforts. And I was thinking a little while ago about where nationalism fits in here. And I'm pro-nationalist too. And I would say that while we're glad for all the nationalist efforts of all people, including non-whites, their struggle is not our struggle. And while we are nationalist and pro-white, so we do call ourselves white nationalists. And it's not that we're against anyone else, but we want our own place, our own country, our own land, and we want to run our own affairs, and we don't think it's a good idea that to live in a mixed society. We've all experienced that, and we see the problems that are inherent in it, which of course in the media they won't admit them, and they try to explain them away or cover them up, but the serious problems are there. So, and we're going to be going into topics like that on this network. So, let's see. Is there anything more to say about why we think this network is necessary?
Well, let's talk about whiteness. I think that that's an important thing to get straight right from the beginning is why white, why explicitly white, and answer or at least preempt some of the criticism or anticipate some of the criticism that we've already heard from people about using white so explicitly and being so explicitly white. And what I would say about that is that pick a term, whatever term you want to pick to hide behind. It doesn't really matter. You will still be attacked if it's white people that are behind it. And if you're trying to even indirectly defend the interests of white people, you'll be attacked as racists. In fact, you could say we could call ourselves the racist network because that's become the popular term for white people is to call them racist, especially when they're kind of trying to do the kind of thing that we're doing. So, you know, white is a term that predates the Jewish takeover and Jewish rule. And I would say there's nothing wrong with the word white from my point of view. Now, our enemies, of course, don't like that, and they don't want us to organize. They don't, because they realize that organizing is the path to success. And you know, anything that we try to do that they do themselves and do successfully, they're going to try and intimidate us or mock us or whatever, keep us from doing it, because they don't want us to be successful. But I have heard criticisms of white from people who I would consider allies or potential allies. And, you know, one of the criticisms is that it is the first step toward this panmixia idea that everybody should mix together. I mean, whiteness is the idea that Europeans are, at least implicitly, all the same, and we should all just intermarry. And a lot of times you get that criticism, at least I'm sort of sensitive to it as an American white nationalist, that we're sometimes mocked by our own cousins in Europe who are nationalists because, you know, from their point of view, their group identity is much narrower. They love other Moldavians or something. You know, they don't really care about Europeans in general. They really just care about their own narrow group of people. And that's exactly, I think, what the difference is when you call yourself a white nationalist, you're saying, I have a broader sense of who my people are. Now, just because I say I'm a white nationalist and support the idea of nationalism for whites in general and that we have something in common with each other in general doesn't mean that I don't have a more specific people in mind that I feel even closer ties to. And ultimately, this is sort of like an onion with many layers. Down at the center, of course, is my family and my extended family, those at the core of the onion. So there's no contradiction here. It's just a matter of a sort of continuum of people who you consider part of your own group and part of your in-group, as they say in sociology or psychology.
Yeah. Well, I definitely have been for quite a while and still am for nationalism in Europe based on the nations. You know, I don't think it's too possible to create this white European nation, if it could be done. I think that the nations of Europe have existed for so long, the cultures are so ingrained, their languages and so on, and that's what should be maintained. So I'm all for nationalists in Europe, say, you know, German nationalists, French nationalists, you know, Moldavian nationalists, and so on. But in the United States, as we have discussed, you know, we don't have that. We're all mixed together. So we decided to call ourselves to focus on white Americans to try to help save the United States of America from going totally under as far as white people are concerned, or white people losing control altogether. And these are all our homelands. You know, it's not like we are expecting other people's ancient homelands to be turned into white places for white people. You know, I mean, this is so incredible that we should be criticized for wanting our own white traditionally and white homelands to become places for race mixing. Yeah. This has been said so many times, but no other peoples are expected to do that. Only us. That's why we know it's an agenda.
Yes.
And I would bring up Horus the Avenger, and you can say what you want about that too, because you know, he's doing a good job. I can't think of what's behind the name behind that right at the moment.
Bob Whitaker. Bob Whitaker's.
Yes, Bob Whitaker, but there's another one. The title of their whole organization or something. But it's Bugs. Well, yeah, I guess so. That's right. And their anti-racist is a code word for anti-white. That's the same thing that we're saying. We're just doing it. We're handling it a little differently. But I agree with that.
Yeah. Well, to go back to the first thing you started with, I agree with your sentiments toward Europe. That is the motherland, the fatherland of white peoples, and we care about it in that level. But we have no authority to tell Europeans what they should do or shouldn't do, or how they should do it. The only people we even have a chance of having any authority with is in America, other people like ourselves in the same boat as us. And we need to get this boat straightened out. We need to get it back on course. And that's where our focus should be. In fact, I think it's a little bit escapist, and I plead guilty to that myself, in looking overseas and hoping or taking pleasure in some good news from some other place. There isn't much good news, but in focusing overseas, it is a way of escaping the nasty business we have here of our own, in our own backyard. But we have to focus here, and it's the only place where we have any footing to do so, any basis, any moral basis to do anything.
Well, I do agree with you. We certainly want solidarity. I think there should be solidarity among all white people, and it just comes naturally. We naturally feel it. You know, I have friends in Europe that I have made, and I'm, you know, very happy to have these friends. They mean a lot to me. And so, but I have come to see that there's no point. I've said this before. There's not much point in me fighting for the German liberation when you know, I'm not there and I'm not German, and I, you know, in that sense, and I can't do it. That what I do have, I do have some authority here, so whatever little authority
as a
citizen.
I lived in Southern California, I went to visit Australia, and this was before I had any really sort of conscious feelings of racial awareness, but I felt quite at home in Australia. These were my people. The cultural norms were the same. The people looked the same. We spoke the same language. We had the same expectations. There were small cultural differences, but they were pretty much cousins. And yet I could drive 60 minutes south and cross the border into Mexico, and I was in an alien land, surrounded by alien people that I didn't trust, that didn't trust me. And I knew all of this before I had any racial understanding of it. Well, now, of course, being conscious of what's going on, I understand why that is, that I felt that way. And it feels much better to understand it than it does to be for it all to be a mystery.
Yes. You know, I had a fairly extensive experience in Mexico and living in Mexico and having the You know, the illusions when I first went down there that every American and Canadian and European who goes there, I found out, basically has that, oh, they're going to just, you know, merge into this culture and learn the language and become friends with Mexicans and just have a totally different experience, because often we're kind of turned off by what's going on in our own countries. At least I was at the time. But boy, did I learn about the depth of culture when I was there. And I'm not going to go into that, but I found that everybody else, every other white person that went there to live, you know, kind of in not in exile, but just find a new home there, just to see what it would be like and so on. They all experience the same thing. The culture is so deep. It's so deep. You have to experience this to understand it. And that's why I do understand that this, you can superficially like people, be polite, get along. You can even enjoy being around them as a kind of a environmental milieu or something if it's pleasant enough. But if you try to really have a deeper or a meeting of minds, often, for the most part, your minds just don't meet. You just don't meet on the way you want to because of your different culture. You just have, it's so many, just down to basic assumptions and so on that would take a lot of work getting over, and people don't want to. So you end up going back to your own kind. And, I think that looking at globalism and the way the world is developing now, that is a good thing. You know, feeling comfortable with our own kind, which I used to think when I was a lot younger, I would have thought, oh, well, that's boring, and that's, you know, stick in the mud, and that's not, you know, I wanted to be sophisticated and cosmopolitan. But I have really changed a lot, and that's from life experience, I think, and not just because I got older and duller or something. So anyway, let's back to this word white. Yes, some people said, oh, that's too, you're going to have trouble with that title. You should call it Ivory. Somebody said, call it the Ivory Network. And someone else said, call it the White Minority Network. And of course, there is a program that's been around for a while, which they call their radio program, White Voice, I think. But it's their website says Save White People. But there again, they have this saving that white people need to be saved. We have to see ourselves as victims somehow.
Yeah.
But, you know, we thought that it's going to be interesting to see if just by having white, just calling this the White Network, just by having white, that this would upset people a lot. We'll see. You know, we're going to find out.
Yeah. Well, When I noticed when I first started using the word white that I was uncomfortable using it. I felt, you know, as if I was doing something wrong or it was just an unfamiliar term. And I've since noticed that in other people. If I start chatting with them about current events and I drop a white into the conversation, you know, talking about us white people, suddenly they get very nervous and they start looking around to see, is anybody listening to us? Is anybody going to hear this incredibly politically incorrect speech? You know, because it's okay to say white, and you can see it in news articles every day where they talk about bad things, whites committing hate crimes or whites, the white population no longer in the majority. That's fine. But to say something positive about whites or say something out of concern for white people, well, that's racism, according to the working practical definition of racism. You know, saying something positive about white people as a group is just something that people aren't used to hearing in everyday speech. And that's part of what I'd like us to do is just set that aside and highlight it even by talking.
We want to get people talking, white people talking about white things and white issues and white concerns. And there is a website, Stuff Black People Don't Like, and then somebody started one, Stuff White People Don't Like, or I don't know which one came first.
Yeah, the white one came first, actually.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not as familiar with that one. Actually, I'm not.
It's Stuff White People Like, actually. And it was very popular.
What they like.
Inspired the black people don't.
Yeah.
I had one thing I wanted to mention about when you were talking about Mexico and how alienated you felt living down there, and the people, the expatriates.
Well, I was very comfortable, but I mean, I just found that if my friendships reverted back to all the white people there, and they felt the same way.
There's an expatriate community there, and it's this is not just white people who do this kind of thing. That's why you have things like Chinatown popping up. Any place where a people is living amongst another people, they search out people like themselves. This is human nature. And I've got a taste of it a little bit, too, just for the critics of whiteness who are white themselves and are skeptical of the idea of whiteness as being too broad. Just to admit, when I moved to the mountains here in Appalachia, I could see that this was a different culture than what I was used to. But I came to it with a very positive attitude, and I realized that I am never going to be accepted as one of these people. But my children my grandchildren hopefully will become integrated into this society and this culture. But I would say to the critics who say, well, look at that, even people you think are just white people and you don't see the subtle differences between them. Well, first of all, I do see the subtle differences. And second of all, if the point is that even, you know, different types of white people can't get along, are incompatible in some way, well, then why the hell should I take the conclusion away from that we should just open up our doors then to every kind of strange alien? I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a non sequitur. It doesn't follow from that point. I acknowledge that point. No, people aren't all the same. And even amongst white people, we have our differences, and they may even be incompatible, where we'll fight our civil wars amongst each other in order to have our independence and self-determination. But the point is, self-determination is it's part of human nature. We want to be in control of our own lives, and if not our own lives, then at least have our proxies, our the people who are in control, our stewards, be someone that we trust and be of our own kind. It's more likely that we will trust them and that they will do what's in our best interest. When we're ruled by aliens, no human being wants to be ruled by alien people, who, especially alien people who have demonstrated a hatred and a dislike for you and your kind. You will rebel against that. It's natural, and that's what we're doing. Is we're rebelling against alien rule here, even though it's only a soft and partial rule at this point. It is enough of a rule. It's a cultural rule, and it's a rule in the domain of ideas. And that's why this idea of discussing with white people what's best for us sounds so revolutionary. It's because it is revolutionary. It's revolutionary against this regime that we have in place right now, that has come into place very stealthily and refuses to even acknowledge its own existence. That is alien rule. It's non-white rule over us. Some people talk about black-run America. And that is so laughable, it's ridiculous. Blacks don't rule America. Jews rule America. And Jews rule our culture right now and effectively rule our government. They tell our government what to do, what laws to pass and what laws can't be passed. We're going to talk about that on this network, too. And we're going to criticize it and we're going to stand against it.
Very good. Diversity among whites. That's an important thing to remember. There is a tremendous diversity among whites. We're not lacking diversity. We don't need people of very different races and so on from all around the world to come to bring us diversity. So that's one thing. And then there's people who say, well, why limit things to whites? There are a lot of good people who aren't white and I'm not even talking about Jews now, I'm talking about other non-Jews, who are not white, but who have the same concerns, and they want the same thing for their people, and why can't we, we should join together, and we should be open to them, and so that we can all work together, and then we'll be stronger, because as whites, we're too weak, we have too many people against us, and so on. Of course, I think I know what you'd say about that. I don't agree with that. And the reason, okay, tell me what you would say why do we emphasize that we want whites, we want to create this white community?
Well, my first reaction is, if you like this other person, well, go live with them. Go live with their family and see what their family has to say about you living with them. So what we're talking about here is a plea for this person to invite aliens into our home. And they want us to look the other way or to smile and pretend that it's good. And it probably would be okay if it were in small numbers. And it probably would even benefit us if it came in small enough doses. But it isn't. And we can see for ourselves the flood it's turned into. It's a genocidal level of immigration that's going on right now into almost every formerly white majority country in the world. And that is not healthy. That is what we're normally told is the cause of or justifies moral outrage. Is this idea that a people are being changed against or killed against their will. And there's lots to say about that, and I've already said a lot about this idea, but and it's tied in a little bit to the White Rabbit work that you've mentioned. In fact, they think that's the main point that we need to drive home, is this genocidal program that's, you know, what I call the anti-white regime. You can fairly describe also as a genocidally anti-white regime, because that's what it's leading to, is it's leading ultimately to us being gone, disappearing.
Okay, and so that's true. So, and why nobody can do it for us. You know, there's that thing too. We have to do it. Whites have to do it. If there are so many whites who want to depend on non-whites, I used to hear it a lot. I haven't heard it so much lately. Maybe I'm not listening to the same people. But say, oh, we need their help. I already did go into that. But
sure.
You know, we have to stand up and do this for ourselves, or it won't be done the way we want it to be done, or in our best interest. Because nobody should be expected to have anybody else's interests in mind. In my estimation, I am not into the altruism thing that much, because I, again, you know, it's a matter of learning over my life what works and what doesn't work. But this altruism doesn't work, and it's not reflected in nature. And I do like to look at nature and see how nature operates, because it was certainly either created or it evolved over time to function in the optimum manner for keeping life going. And keeping life going is what any group of people is all about, their own survival of their own kin and so on. And this is the way you do it, is by self-interest, and everything functions out of its own self-interest. And it usually then, if there's no unnecessary hostility, you know, things go along as best they can. They're not going to be perfect. There's no perfection.
Yeah,
there's no utopia.
The only examples of altruism that exist, as far as I know, in nature, other outside of humankind, are to turn out to be family relationships, genetic relationships, you know, cousins or better. And every time they investigate some example of the altruism, they end up finding a genetic relationship there, where it seems almost as if the genes are manipulating these organisms to serve the genetic interests. That's Richard Dawkins' idea behind the selfish gene, that it's almost as if the gene is the thing that's alive, and we're just a vessel through which it propagates itself. I don't take that kind of a view. I mean, that's kind of an extreme. I think he was trying to make a point in describing it that way. But it's true. And if we don't serve our interests, nobody else is going to serve it. You know, the Mexican gardener who moves here to make a better life for himself and his family isn't doing your gardening for you because he likes you. He's doing it because it's making him the money he needs to raise his own family. And that's exactly what's happening. His family is being raised, and he's having a family, while so many Americans feel like they don't have enough money to have babies, and so instead they treat themselves to vacations and partying instead. And
Oh, that is. I'm glad you said that because it leads into what I was going to say next. You know, that is such a mistake. That is such a horrible path that we've gone down. This idea that we don't need to have children. And you know, I fell into that myself. So we're also about folk and family. On this network, that's what white means to us. What would you have to say about that? Anything? You want to add to
that? Yeah, the family is the future. The children are the future. And it was having children that first was my first step toward a racial consciousness. When my kids went to school, certainly, and I saw what kind of school that they were in, and that it was mostly Mexicans, or very quickly in the town that I was in, very quickly turning mostly Mexican. The one school that was left that my kids were going into was still majority white, but it was changing very rapidly. And a lot of white Americans have this realization, and the whole phenomenon of white flight is a sign that white people do realize at some level what they like and what they don't like, and that they don't like sending their children to schools that are majority non-white, which is the main thing driving white flight when families realize that their kids are going to be in schools that are mostly non-white. They pick up and they move at great expense to themselves someplace where they will have majority white schools. And it's something that in the past they maybe took for granted. White flight was only away from the inner city to the suburbs. Well, nowadays people are fleeing from one suburb to another trying to get away from what they don't like. And it's really just I was going to say that it's just that white people won't speak out about it, won't speak out openly, but actually white people do speak out against it and about it. And lots of people have spoken out against it and have failed. But that doesn't diminish my own need to speak out against it. And part of why I'm doing this with you is I want to go on record against this, against what's happening, and for what I would rather happen. And I see a lot of support out there for us, at least implicitly. There are lots of people who I think would agree with us if they weren't busy looking over their shoulder to see who is going to, shake their finger at them not like them.
Well, another aspect of this folk and family is our lifestyles and the way we live. Because, we have gotten used to what we would call a Judaized environment and lifestyle in the United States and in Europe, where really it's going on everywhere, in all white countries, where we expect a lot of sophisticated entertainments, and we have all this electronic entertainment and like you say, things that take away from simple family life and caring, where just your children and your little home and your neighbors and your simple entertainments over the weekend or something, and work and cooking and food and just just the things that used to make up all of life are just something that we do in order to be able to enjoy ourselves all the rest of the time, I guess. And this whole life of amusements that we see now in films and blockbuster this and huge sporting events and all of that, we have to wean ourselves away from that if we're going to make any headway in our lives in changing things. And your move was a part of that. And also you told me that you just recently, your family went to Dollywood. And why don't you just mention your experience at Dollywood for real quick?
Well, Dollywood is an amusement park. It's like Frontierland in Disney World. If you've ever been to Disney World, it's like that one section, because it's a place to walk around and you hear country music, you hear Dolly Parton type music, bluegrass music playing in the background, and there's all sorts of American food to eat, and all sorts of Americans walking around, and American heritage is celebrated there. They have blacksmiths and glass blowing and all sorts of arts and crafts, in addition to the Six Flags type rides, which aren't the attraction for me. For me, the attraction is the massive number of white people in one place. And it is so many white people that it is glaring when you see the occasional non-white face walking around. They really look alien and strike you as completely out of place. And they must feel out of place, too, because the entire milieu is white and Appalachian white. It's mostly working class, fairly poor, or at least people of ordinary means that go to Dollywood. And it's still a wholesome, a fairly wholesome place to go. It's certainly preferable to Disney.
Well, do you think, you know, it seems to me that we have gotten so used to other things that, I know what I was going to say, that we have gotten so used to multiculturalism and seeing all these non-whites around us that would we feel guilty? Are we suffering from something where we would have guilt if we were just among whites like you were?
It would be a strange, I can tell you from my own experience, pre-racial awareness, I would have felt a strange conflict. I would have felt happy instinctually, but then I would have felt guilty about feeling happy. And I wouldn't have known why I felt either feeling or why they clashed. But going there and being racially aware, I felt happy. The only sadness, and I was aware of this too, consciously, is when you see the very obese people, the mixed race couples, the few non-whites that were there were usually there as part of a mixed race couple. And to just think how 50 years ago or even more recently that those people would have been run off by the crowd, who just would have not wanted to have seen them and not accepted them in their presence. But the problem that you're talking about, or you started off and talking about here, is a general trend toward materialism and the hedonism that comes with it. And this focus on the sensuality and pleasing yourself in the here and now. And that's partly why the people don't have kids is they're too busy pleasuring themselves. And I could, you would said that you didn't have kids. Well, for a long time, I didn't have kids and I didn't want kids. And ultimately, my wife was pretty adamant that she wanted kids. So I had kids, and what I found out once I had kids was how wonderful it was to have kids. I had thought it was nothing but a burden before I had kids. And even though I come from a fairly large family with plenty of brothers and cousins and other family members, I took it for granted. And I think that's what a lot of people do when it comes to families. They just take it for granted. And they take for granted that the government is going to take care of them when they get older. And, having kids is a joy. It's a safety net. Yes, there are tough things. You will have a kid wake up at 3 a.m. and need to go to the hospital with some strange ache or pain. That will happen, but it doesn't hold a candle to the good things. The kid who looks in your eye and says, "I love you, Daddy," those experiences, and teaching them something, passing on what you've learned and tricks that you've learned to your own kids and seeing them be successful in life. That is just immeasurable. There's no value that can be attached to that. It just completely outweighs the bad.
Well, I think this culture that I call this Judaized culture has done this to us, has caused us to see having children as a burden. It's caused us to see a lot of things as boring. Life is boring. And of course, it's always giving us, it's always building up this celebrityhood, this celebrity. I don't want to waste any time on that, but this business of sticking celebrities in our faces 24/7, it's just kill. It's death dealing. It's death dealing. We should somehow get away from all this stuff. This is not real life.
It's not the cause of the problem, but it is definitely yet another symptom of it. And it's an escapism. It's a lot like you mentioned the entertainment aspect, which I consider part of the hedonism aspect. Which is this, people look around and I think whether they realize it consciously or not, life is pretty miserable. Even though you may have a big house, a McMansion that you live in, and multiple cars, and go on trips to Disney or wherever, you're actually kind of uncomfortable with what's going on. You hear all this bad news coming from the outside world, and you look around, and you see all these surly, aliens eyeballing you, and you know if you stare back at them, you know they're gonna get violent, and if they get violent, you're the one who's going to be going to jail or the hospital. And it's this is a very, very bad situation for white people, and they sense it, even the ones who aren't racially
conscious. Yeah, yeah, I guess they sense it. Go ahead.
Following these celebrities, just to finish the thought, is one way of escaping it. You know, look at these rich people, and look, I can look at their wonderful home, and oh, isn't that nice? And I want to be just like them. And they people fantasize. It's a fantasy world. The younger kids go into virtual reality and escape into the internet in that way. So, and the ironic, here's an ironic thing. Sometimes we're criticized, people like us who are talking on the internet. The internet facilitates us being able to communicate fine and communicate with each other. And we're told that, you know, somehow we're escaping, you know, we're keyboard commandos or something, trying to escape reality. And I suppose there's some truth to that. I guess I could be going out into the world and banging my head, you know, knocking on doors, trying to find other people who are awake and who are white. But the reality is that if I went to my neighbors, most of them wouldn't want to talk about this stuff. They're uncomfortable talking about it. So the internet is a good place where we can talk about it. We can find like minds, and it will grow. People, as they discover explanations that do a better job of explaining why they feel uncomfortable or why things are happening, and I think they gravitate toward those things. And that's why our enemies don't want us to talk and want to shut us down and actively try to shut us off. I mean, if they thought what we were doing was nonsense, they would just ignore us. But they don't ignore us. They try to shut us down. So now we're too young, this particular network, we just started. So we'll see it, how they come at us. But, you know, the past, I think we've got plenty of examples where pro-white organizations have been attacked in every imaginable way. And most of them have been taken down. And they do that because they are threatened by us.
Well, we need our supporters to help support us and stand behind us. Okay, what about, this brings me to right to, who do we want or expect to reach? Or who are we trying to reach, Tan?
Well, this is a tough one for me. I've never wanted to be an evangelist, and I don't consider myself an evangelist, and I mean that in a broad sense, not in a religious sense, but in the idea that I have some great news or a solution to the problem, and I want everybody to hear it. And the problem is I haven't been able to get a big enough audience yet. I think that this is a bit beyond our control, and we're just little grains of sand in a big storm here. And you know, for me, the main thing is just staying true to ourselves and true to what we think is the right thing to do, and the honest truth as far as we can see it, and talking about it. And I think it will grow from there. I sort of have a...
Well, yeah, I wasn't so much thinking about how many people we would reach, but who we thought we would reach or how we could reach. And we have discussed that we're not trying to reach everyone, and we're not trying to reach all whites. And my thought on this is that most whites are not reachable at this point, and they're not going to be reachable until the whole political paradigm or power structure changes. And that's like you said, your neighbors, same with me. I can't go and talk to people about this. They're totally uncomfortable. They'd walk away or change the subject or something. Well, you know, they're just not ready for it. But those who are, we hope, you know, that's all we can do is to build our core.
Yes, and that's what I was getting at when I mentioned the neighbor thing. Now, on the flip side of that, or along with that, goes the fact that I am surprised sometimes when I bring up things, when I talk about racial issues with friends and neighbors, acquaintances. Usually, if I do it in a small group or one-on-one, then I get nothing but nods of agreement. I mean, they may be a little bit uncomfortable talking about it at first, but they realize this is a private conversation, and this person isn't going to rat me out. In fact, I'd be the one ratting them out. And so then they warm up a little bit and they admit, oh, yeah, I am concerned about that. Or, oh, yeah, that is terrible. But whenever it's in groups, when it's a large number of people, then everybody is worried that somebody else is the secret police and is going to turn them in or think less of them or whatever, get upset with them. from seeing so many Jews throwing tantrums the minute they hear any sort of racial talk about anything. The Jew in the group will start getting uncomfortable, and if you push them far enough, will start throwing a tantrum and make it very, very unpleasant. It's one of the mechanisms.
Yeah, and that's why we need to reach our core. We need to build a core. We have core supporters. We have core pro-white people. But yeah. Sometimes they are kind of get swayed this way and that way. It's really hard to know exactly what the parameters are, why you should stay very strict, or where you should stay very strict, and why it's important, and so on. So I think one thing we want to do, and even to come to better understanding ourselves, is to understand what our issues are, and to have the resolve to stand our ground. And to not give way, because what happens is that most of us, we have our strong beliefs, but then if out there we're bullied and insulted, even on the internet, we might back down, unless you're just being a big show off. There's a lot of that going on. I'm not speaking about that, where you just start insulting one another and calling people names. But we need to learn, I think, to as white people, to be very firm and very solid about our white issues, and not to be back and forth about them, or not to feel apologetic anymore, or not to wonder if we're really right. Do I really have a right to do this?
Politeness has to go, take a back seat, and likewise with compromise. I don't mind compromising when it comes to other white people, and I don't mind arguing. Arguing about what's best for white people, fine. Let's argue about that. There's nothing wrong with that. But let's not get into divisive arguments that our enemies, that only serve our enemies' interests. In fact, the divide and conquer is a very favorite tactic of theirs, and one that they've used all these decades against us, and to great success, divided us.
Yeah, that's true. But sometimes... things are called divide and conquer, or people are accused of being divisive when they're just trying to make a point or something that is not as popular. Maybe they have they're stronger and can stand up against something that others are uncomfortable with. It's the same uncomfortable quality, that many whites have, that we were talking about with neighbors and so on. You have to kind of distinguish there.
You play it by ear. People... Our whole jury system of law is based on the assumption that people can judge for themselves the truth. It's hard to quantify it, but that's why we trust juries to make the right decisions, at least as a whole. That there is something to human judgment, and even on the internet, there's a saying that nobody can tell you're a dog on the internet, but it's not entirely true. When I've argued with people on the internet, I can tell whether they're arguing in good faith or not. Especially the longer you argue with them, the better able you are to discern whether this is a person who is genuinely trying to hash out some important issue and come to some understanding of what I'm saying, and I understand what they're saying, and we go back and forth, and we finally hammer out some conclusion, even if the conclusion is that we can't come to agree. And we do it in a way that's open and honest, versus a person who is obviously just trying to confuse you, obviously just trying to obscure rather than to clarify, somebody who's just trying to waste your time and cause division. And I think, most people may not be totally conscious of doing that or the need to do that, but a lot of people get that sense just intuitively. From the people they're arguing with, that there's some value in that.
Yes, I think so. I think we have to have a lot of discussion, and we shouldn't be shutting people up unless they are really being abusive or ridiculous or ugly. Anyway, we're coming to the top of the hour, we haven't told our listeners how we've got this set up. We decided to have, for this program, every program, the host will decide how they want to run their program. But But for the Heretics Hour now, it's going to be just a break at the top of the hour, 5-minute break. And is that going to be on the hour, or does it start before the hour, or what?
It should start a few minutes before the hour and extend over the hour.
All right. And so that's coming up in a couple minutes, but maybe 3 minutes. So I just wanted to let you folks know we're just going to have musical breaks. A 5-minute break we think is good for, I think it's good for people to, you know, do other things or check other things or whatever, or just have a break for me and my guests. So that's what it's going to be. And we've got some of the music, the Franz Liszt Les Preludes music to play. And I might change that later to vary the music, but that's what's playing tonight. So when this comes along, we've got 60 seconds until the music will start, and we'll go on our break. And then we will be back, and we're going to talk about our programming and our policy on new hosts, and if we're going to have comments, and then we have some other things to talk about. So there's still a lot of interesting conversation here tonight, ladies and gentlemen, so stay with us. Until we come back from our break. I'm anticipating it a little bit ahead. I don't need to, because I think the music is going to come in very smoothly. But I hope you've enjoyed this so far. And Tan and I will be back in 5 minutes. Thank you. if they were going to be open yet. So, well, I don't want to leave where I am right now. I'm too nervous about losing my nice screen here. Well, I can go here. I can look at Tanstaff. Oh. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager. I'm your host for the Heretics Hour. And I'm still learning my way around how to operate this system that Tan has created. And my guest tonight is Tan Stoffel from Age of Reason blog, Age of Treason blog. One of these days I'll quit saying reason. And so we're in our second hour now, and we are going to, I said that we were going to talk about our programming for the White Network. We're still on the topic of the White Network. Telling you about it. We are not able to take any callers, so we can't answer your questions. But we do have comments on our website, and this program will have a program page after this live broadcast. And you can write comments, and I will certainly answer any that I think I should answer. So that's a nice feature that I have missed in the past year or so. And I don't have comments, you know, on my website. So people have questioned about that, but it just seemed to be too difficult. So, but anybody can write things to me here if they want to comment. So that'll be good. Now, our programming, Tan, we have a program schedule, and it's not a lot on it yet, but there are some things. So this program is on Monday nights, and then you are going to do a program of your own on Tuesdays, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And you don't know if you're not going to start that tomorrow because you're on here tonight, but probably will start it maybe the following week.
Yeah, I don't want to commit to anything, any more shows. As you said at the beginning here, this is all brand new, and we're going to have to work out the kinks here on this one show. And once we have this running smoothly and you're comfortable operating it, then I think I'll have the spare time to actually do a show. As anybody who's been reading my blog knows, I haven't been blogging because I don't have any spare time to do anything but what I've been doing for this, to create this network, to put together the software. So I'm looking forward to being able to do blogs again and being able to do a show, but I have to say that we have to finish this and get it working. Part of my ambition here and part of what's going to be different from VOR is I shouldn't have to be here helping to orchestrate the show. You and your guests should be able to do the show. And so far tonight, I haven't really done anything besides be a guest too. So, it looks pretty good so far, but there are some pieces that aren't done yet, automatically posting the thing, and I won't go into all the details, but I want to be comfortable that everything is working smoothly before I say, okay, we're ready to have a second and a third and so on show, and especially my own show. That's maybe the last thing I'll do. You have a couple of shows that you'd like to do a second show, and we have tentative plans for a show that we can do together. I don't know how much you want to talk about that.
Yeah, well, I would like to a little bit. Okay. I think people are interested, and this is pretty firm. I think we're very firm on this because I've been kind of the one with the international Jew, Henry Ford's book, and we got real interested in that quite a while back, and we thought it would be a good idea. We both agreed wholeheartedly that we'd like to do a whole program, a series of programs going through that book, and so now we've got something figured out here where we will have a program on Thursday nights, and I made it an hour and a half, thinking that was probably long enough. It could go longer. I think it maybe could be done in an hour. We were going to, if we do a chapter at each time, and then we're going to, it will lead into a lot of discussion. And the way I was seeing it is that it's basically how the Jews took over America. American Jews, but there's more to it in Ford's book than that. This is I think just a fantastic resource. And it's kind of like the protocols in that there's so much in it, you just need to really study it. So this is what we plan to do with that program. And I think we have the music picked out, which is Henry Ford himself playing the fiddle with was he playing with Henry Mencken, or is that his name, Henry?
Oh, I don't know. Did you find something with Henry Ford actually playing? All I found was a site that had talked about what his favorite music was.
It's his favorite music. I thought he was playing that music. I thought him actually playing the music. His favorite. Okay,
it's just a sample of the
That's pretty good. So I think we could get that together, not this coming week, because that would just be a couple days from now, but for the following week. But then my other program that I'm really looking forward to is having an afternoon program on Saturdays from 2 to 4 Eastern, which would make it like 11 to 1 Pacific time. That's going to be a relaxed show. I have a couple of guests lined up already. So, you know, I'm raring to go. Now, Tan, you're cautious and you want to make sure, you know, you're not ready to rush into anything, and I'm ready to rush right in. I can hardly wait. So I don't know if I'll be able to do that show this coming Saturday, but yeah. I would like to try it. Because as you say, this whole system is running very smoothly. But that's what we have in mind for ourselves. Now, we're also open to new hosts, and there is someone who has who we thought about ourselves and has then came on his own and expressed an interest in doing it. But it will be a little while before that can be worked out also. But I just want people to know that that we do plan on having other shows and other hosts, not just us, but don't have a whole lineup to start with.
Okay. You know, the second show on Saturday afternoons, what are you planning to talk about on that show? What is your focus going to be there?
Well, I'm going to use that show to be able to talk to some people in Europe who I like to bring on, and it's difficult for a night show because of the time difference. So I might be talking to a lot of Europeans, but I'll also be talking to friends and interesting guests that I think would fit in well and that fit in there. Or I have too many if I can't, you know, it'll be 2 hours too, so I'll have this Heretics Hour show and I'll have that one too. It'll just depend on where I think it fits best. And I also want to do, yes, I'm glad you asked me that. I almost forgot. I would like to have some panel discussions. And this came up because there was a discussion about Christianity versus paganism and so on, and amongst white nationalists. And I, right away, there were four people involved talking, you know, coming to mind. And they all said they would be, including you and I, of course, and two others. They said they would be more than happy to join in that. So I think I'd like to have some discussions with three or four people at a time. That would be a little tricky, so that won't happen right away.
Right. Yes. Skype is a little bit squirrely for me right now. Still, occasionally, I do something wrong and it crashes. So the more callers you have, the more likely that is to happen.
Yes, right, yeah, and more for me to figure out, so or me to just watch over. But I think that Saturday show will be just kind of casual. I've even got the music. I found some music that I think will be just right for it. So I'm ready as soon as Tan will work with me on it and let me go on the air with it.
Well, it's not that I'm not willing to. I am optimistic and excited about doing this stuff, but I know my limitations physically because of the constraints of my family and my profession. Mm-hmm. And I also know from my profession, you know, doing software is what I do for a living. I know that the best laid plans oft go awry, and you know, you can plan to ship on a certain date and it's just not ready. And that's what happened to us for these past few weeks, that I always wanted it to be working by next week, but as you know, it wasn't for many weeks.
Yes, but it wasn't so many. Just you weren't sure. We held off, right? But now it is. So everything does eventually get done. I do have a hard time waiting for things, but I've been doing one show a week. Now this is me. You know, I've been doing one show a week, and that's been fine. Now, as soon as I get it in my mind and I write it down. Well, I got a show Monday. I got a show Saturday. And then there's this interesting Thursday show about Henry Ford. Then right away I want to do them all, you know, now. So I certainly can wait.
I want to enable you to do that too. I can't commit to having more than one show, just because of the constraints on my time. But I certainly want to make it possible for you and for other white people to come forward. And this is something I had wanted to say too, is because of my own situation, being married to a woman whose father was Jewish, and I have a very dim view of Jews as a group, and I think other white people should come to a similar understanding. If they knew what I knew, that I think many would, that I am in that way flawed or compromised, and I don't put myself forth as a leader, but I do want to help in any way I can, and so I want to. That's the spirit in that moves me is to enable other white people to come forward and to do what they can.
Well, I'm sure I know you've said this. I am looking forward to your show very much, and I hate the idea that I have to wait for several more weeks before you get on the air. But I hope you do start blogging again. At least I miss your blogs too.
As long as I'm spending so much time on the White Network, I can't. I don't. I just.
Yeah, you are. But you know, don't you have the basic structure there now?
There's always something.
The worst part. Yeah, there is something. Well, I hope you don't end up being enslaved by it, because you're the one that has to fix and fine tune and take care of everything. So we'll hope that.
Right. Well, I said from the beginning that I don't want to become enslaved, and that's part of why I want to. Or I didn't put it in that terms. I said I don't want to.
You don't want to have to run everybody's show, you know.
Exactly. I think that limits the scale of what you can build. If you have to be there, if somebody has to physically be there to put up every show, you become a bottleneck. And I don't want that to happen. I want it to be so that you can basically produce a show all by yourself, and you're totally capable of doing it. And anyone we bring on needs to be capable of doing it too, to make a program page for themselves. And to be able to operate a computer in the certain basic ways that you can. And I will make the system to the best of my ability so that it's idiot-proof and able to be operated by somebody who can click on a mouse and maybe type a few keys. And I think it's possible. From what I've done so far, I think that I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. It's just some of these features are a little trickier than others, and I haven't had time to make them all. But there's much more to do.
Okay. Well, all right. I forgot what I was going to say now, so I'll move on. You had some people asking about some things on saying what they would like for us to do on this network on your blog. You have some good followers on your blog, and they were very excited about this. And they want us to talk about the needs of white families. And one said they thought we should talk about our language, our use of language, and how white people are still using the enemy's language and can't seem to, you know, get over it and quit doing that. I agree with that very much. But it is hard. It is hard. But then you had also said there was something about the majorities that you wanted to address when we came back from break.
Well, I think language is very important. It's crucial. In a meme war, which we're in, a war of ideas, language is absolutely critical. Now, I'm not saying that if you choose the wrong word, that's it, you know, game over. But I am saying that our use of language, and certainly when we pay attention to what people are saying, I've benefited a lot by paying close attention to the shades of meaning and pulling them apart to discern to tell friend from enemy, for instance, as I was saying earlier about getting a sense when you discuss with people, even on the internet, you can tell who's white and who's a Jew from subtle hints.
Yeah, that's
yeah. Tricky. As far as the majority goes, the majority. I wanted to bring that up because it's you know, for many decades now, we've been retreating as a people from the word white and from being explicit about who we are and what it is that we want, what's best for us, and we've fled to several euphemisms for ourselves instead, words like majority, words like conservative, and I don't think that that's a good sign. You know, we basically abandoned what was perfectly good and workable for something that, if you want to say that white is flawed because, you know, there's so many divisions amongst white people and white people aren't all the same, well, you could say the same thing about majorities, and you could say the same thing about conservatives. And in fact, you know, I've said this before, when people criticize the word white, when our enemies do, they're full of crap anyway, and you know they are, because they don't have a problem with Latino or Black or Jew, which are just as amorphous, just as vague in their definition, and people argue about those things incessantly. And so we will argue too about what white is, but that doesn't make the concept invalid. And even my criticism or my mentioning majority or conservative, I'm not really saying that those words are meaningless or should be abandoned, but it's not a good sign. I think that somebody who's talking about white interests and aiming what they're saying at white people euphemizes and instead calls them the majority. Does that mean tomorrow when they become the minority, they're going to stop caring about them, or they have to go back and edit everything that they said and say, oh, no, I didn't mean the majority. I meant, you know, the soon to be minority majority. You know, I don't do what I do and I don't feel the way I feel because my people are in the majority. Or if, for that matter, even though I come from a more conservative leaning politically, I don't care so much about conservatism either. That's not why I care about people, because they're conservative and agree with me ideologically. So I thought that was a good point to bring up. It might have been better to mention that when we were talking about the whole concept of whiteness earlier, but I did want to get that in.
Well, yeah, the... this idea of using these words, I think, is very interesting. Calling it the majority, calling white people the majority or something else, and calling Jewish people, oh, that the chosen group or that other group, or calling Blacks and Hispanics something else. Or even the word Hispanic. See, I'm sorry I'm using that word. I do have a hard time, but I'd say it. I almost always say it, mestizo. But it feels like it's a... It still feels to me like I'm being disrespectful to Mexicans. But they're not all Mexicans, see? So if I can't say Mexicans, because we're talking about the whole, you know, people from a lot from Central America and even South America. So you have to give them a name. Well, they're South American Indian Spanish mixture. Well, mestizo, I've heard, means somebody said it just the other night. But I've forgotten what they said. It sounded pretty good. But, you know, people, but I don't, I am very much against using the word Hispanic for these people. Not to put these people down. I mean, if you want to think, if they want to think that being Indian is something, is an insult to them, well, they are Indian. You know, yeah. How can they be insulted by what they are? This is a big problem that we have, because we're not at all insulted by what we are. And that's why they kind of people hold it against us. Everybody's happy to be white, but not everybody's happy to be Black. And that's not our problem, though.
That's not our problem. This is the point. Yeah. But this is one of the important things about language. And it's not just the choice of words, but who gets to choose the words. That is critical. And in this case, I feel magnanimous and I feel like I don't mind calling them whatever they want to call themselves. I mean, I think it's kind of funny that every couple of years they change. You know, Negroes became Blacks, became African Americans. It's kind of silly, and I still hesitate. I won't bother to call them African American because it's a mouthful. It's inconvenient. And I think at a certain level, people delight at that inconvenience to white people,
yes,
having everybody run around calling them African Americans and the kind of senseless things that happen when you get TV commentators talking about blacks in Africa in the Olympics and calling them African Americans, you know, because their mind is so conformed to speaking the way they think they have to speak. You know, that's part of the rule. That's part of the Jewish rule is this control over our minds that we can't even choose our words for ourselves and what words we decide to use. But as I said, I'm magnanimous as far as other groups are concerned. I don't mind calling them Latinos. They want to call themselves Latinos today, and next year it's going to be something else.
No.
Whatever. I mean, to
not,
a certain extent.
Not me.
That even bothers me more.
Latino really bothers me. Because that's just dressing yourself up into something you're not. They're not Latinos. They're not Latins. There's nothing Latin about them.
Well, that's what they call themselves. That's how they organize.
I know, sure. Well, we could dream up some.
But that's their problem.
Too. We can call ourselves geniuses. How about that? Now we want you all to call us geniuses.
Genius Americans.
That's our new name.
Yeah. Well, and you see, just doing that thought experiment, you can see what the reaction would be. Both of whites and non-whites to such an assertion, we'd be laughed at and mocked and ridiculed for even thinking that we could do that. And, you know, it would be merciless. But, you know, God forbid you'd say something about how stupid the African-American locution is. That's just, you know, that's an unthinkable racism to mock a people's name like that. And, I don't know, but I do think it's important. And the point I made is not just the language, but who gets to dictate what can be said and who can say it. You know, one of the words "nigger" in today's society is one of these probably the most third rail of political correctness. That if you say that word, if you're black, it's okay. You can say that. You can get up on stage. You can make money saying that word. And everybody laughs. But if you're a white guy and you say it, oh, you'd better say how, you know, it's some story you're reporting on. Even if you're reporting on a story, it's not okay to say for a white guy to say that word. You have to you revert to baby speak and call it the N-word. Now, you know, this is one of the things I would take a cue from VOR on, and Mike Connor had this policy, that he didn't want words like that used on the air at VOR. He was aiming at making making a family friendly environment, and I sort of agree with that. And I think we're intelligent enough to come up with clever ways of saying what we need to say, that we don't have to resort to slurs, gratuitous slurs, to get our point across. And we should probably avoid them if we can. If we can make our point without calling people niggers and kikes and certain beaners, whatever, that we should do that. And but then again, just like I am now, if we need to talk about these things, not hesitate to use the language that we need to use to talk about it, and not have to revert to code speak about the N-word and so forth in order to show our deference to other peoples, that they might get offended at us. They certainly don't act like that when they call us names.
Well, that just shows who's in control. And it's really not the blacks who are in control. They've been given a large measure of control by their Jewish helpers, who are just using them cynically. So, but really, it's so screwed up. And that's why, we have to stand firm together, and we have to build a strong core. That we may think we have a strong core now, but I'm not so sure what it's made up of. And of course, we can't all be in some group that everybody knows about, because then we'd just be attacked. So it is a little bit sensitive, but people can recognize who's who by what we're saying and how we're saying it, I guess. But you know, speaking about our language, I don't know if this is very pertinent or not, but Severus Nicholson in his latest blog, he says that, language is, we have a collective perception in the groups that becomes a part of things. And if we demonize someone or stereotype someone, if it's based on an acceptance by a group in their perception of it, even if it's wrong, that this can actually help to strengthen this idea about people. So if we are demonized by words like racist or hater or fascist or what have you, or Nazi, or if there is a belief in this in the general perception in amongst the people, if that has been instilled in them enough, those words will have an effect, even if they may not on a conscious level or thinking level say, oh yes, I agree with that, but that will reinforce it. And so he is saying that we should do the same things. He has a more revolutionary attitude, but that we should do the same thing, because there are negative stereotypes,
yes,
about liberals and about communists and what are some of these other people, and multiculturalists and multiracialists and so on, and mixed people he uses some of these words that we could call them. I don't know how well this works, but hippie, degenerate, freak, wimp, fag, yeah, hypocrite, bum, junkie. I mean, be really nasty, because and that this will have an effect, because underneath it all, these words do connect with people's perceptions of these these liberal people.
Ultimately, I have a couple of thoughts about this one. Ultimately, I think that's why blacks have to change their name every so often, is because the name that they have been using for a while eventually becomes associated with their very stereotypical behavior. There are two types of stereotypes, two opposite ends of the spectrum. Luke O'Farrell wrote an essay several years ago, and he was one of the heretical two that was ultimately put on trial and jailed for thought crimes in mm-hmm. England, in Britain. And he wrote an essay where he pointed out that there are two types of stereotypes. One that's a stereotype because it's true, and everybody sees it, and it becomes a sort of joke. And the other type of stereotype is sort of the inversion of reality. And I don't think he made this point, but I'll make it. The inverted reality stereotypes, I think, take root and have force because they're promulgated by propaganda. They're by sheer repetition and from the source that they're coming from, the authoritative source that they come from. You've heard the expression the King's English before. Well, they called it the King's English because whatever the king decided was in the language was the language. That was the way it was spelled, and that's the way it was pronounced by the king. So he was the ultimate authority for the language. But and I make that point because there are these two sides to language. One is common use, and words change and meaning changes over time through a sort of collective glacial motion and force of momentum from a whole population deciding how they're going to speak. And then the other side of it is the King's English side, the authority who says, I want it to be this way, and writes books and publishes them about, this is how to spell it, this is how to pronounce it. And in our society today, the Jews are the kings who say what the language will be and who can use it. And, but we still have the power of popularity and truth and emphasizing these stereotypes that are based in reality. It's a bit easier for us, even though we may not have the big megaphones, the broadcasting facilities that the Jews do and their allies. We do have the force of reality behind us. We don't have to invert reality and repeat it over and over again to make it true.
Yeah, but if you do repeat it, I guess it really does work. I mean, we know that propaganda works.
Well, and we can do both.
I think we don't do it as well. It's being done to us, and we're not doing it back. What he's saying is that, right or wrong, he's saying that we should do it back, even if it sounds rude. I mean, he's talking about using rude names and so on. But he's saying that this is war, and he said you're not directing it your name calling, so to speak, at the person, but you're directing it at the audience, the listeners who are around, who are consuming it. And even if they, I guess, even if they don't applaud it, they might. It, he says it's a seed. He calls it like a demon seed. It's a nugget of truth that you put this demon seed in people's minds, yeah. And sometimes, and then it grows and it comes back out. And that this is like everything's okay in war.
That choice of words, it kind of rubs me wrong, though. It's he's demonizing himself and his own tactic. I mean, makes it very easy then for our enemies to say, look, even he says he's going to try and demonize us good people by his choice of words. And now maybe he doesn't care. That's his point.
They're demonizing us is what he's saying. We need to realize that day in, day out, and for a long time now, they have been demonizing us. Yeah. And we need to demonize back. Now this is kind of a tactical thing, which I would like to instill, bring in here, is that this idea that people say, well, I wouldn't do the kind of things that they do. I wouldn't treat people the way they treat people. And then the other way is that we should do what they do. We should treat them the way they treat us, which is the right way to go.
Well, I can imagine debates amongst the Indians when they were trying to resist the white man who had superior weaponry that, our traditional bow and arrow is better and we should remain true to ourselves. And they were just swept aside. So we have to adopt what works and not... I don't think we have to worry so much about our nature changing, because that's kind of the point, is we can't change our nature. And we won't turn into them simply by copying the tactics that work, by adopting the tactics that work. That's one of the doubts, I think, that they would love to grow in our mind and probably spend a lot of effort trying to plant in our minds. Don't do that. You don't want to identify as a group. Oh, why would you, want to organize as white people? I mean, after all, who's white? And so they constantly try to instill these doubts in our minds that we shouldn't do this and we shouldn't do that. And it always turns out those are the things that would work. Those are the things that might work, and certainly work for them. So I say, I'm with Nicholson on that let's use what works.
Okay. Let's see if there's anything more to that. And then I want to move on to
one more word. What do they call them? Israel firsters. This is in the news just in the last couple of months. The Jews are very, very upset about anybody using the term Israel firster. Well, what is Israel firster? Is that a slur? I mean, is it an insult?
No.
To them? It's not even, it's an insult, and it's based on who uses it and what the purpose is of using it. See, they realize that who's using the word is important and what the point of using that word is. You can get a Jew who will stand up in front of the whole public, the whole world, and say, I love Israel and I want this or that. And you could rightly say they're an Israel firster because they put Israel's interests first and just in a literal sense. And they will get upset about that. They will, you're attacking them. You want to exterminate all the Jews and you show it by using such terminology. But you don't even need the word Israel first as an example. That Jew is a word. That works the same way. If you just want to talk about what's going on, you want to talk about Jewish influence, to even say Jew in a negative context, saying something critical about Jews, it makes most people nervous. I know the first times that I started to do it, I felt uncomfortable doing it. And that's not so much a sign that you're doing something wrong. It's a sign that you're basically fighting this brain damage or mental, what do they call it? No, abuse. If it's done to children, it is. If you indoctrinate them in something stupid or that's harmful to them, you call it child abuse. And, mm-hmm. and it's mental abuse if you yell at somebody and degrade them and tell them what a horrible person they are. Well, they've taught us to do it to ourselves. That we have to think these negative thoughts about ourselves whenever we have a feeling, hey, I don't like being ripped off by these alien people. I don't like being told what to do by these alien people. Ooh, I feel bad about myself. I shouldn't say those things about the poor Jews because they've been oppressed for their whole lot, their whole history. And
I think that's Severus's point is that we should not feel guilty about any of this stuff because what they're doing to us is so terrible. We need to start fighting back.
But we can't just say, well, you shouldn't feel that. I think it's a little more complicated than that. You have to explain this to people and how the mechanism works and what it does to you, and then say, look, you could be free of this. Just becoming aware of it is the first step toward freeing yourself of this.
Yeah, and well, you know, I had an experience.
Show them how to defuse the bomb.
Yeah, I won't go into it now. I've talked about it before. But when I had the experience of realizing how I felt about the word Jew, and that it was like something you couldn't say, and I heard somebody saying it, and I thought, oh, he said that. He said Jew. What, you know, like something was going to happen from that. He was going to get in trouble or something. I don't know. And then it's just that just popped to open my mind at that moment. And I thought, what in the world? Why can't we say Jew? They call each other Jew all the time. And here we are. And I realized that. I probably had quite some preparation for it. But where was I going with that? Well, you were saying, I forgot where I was going with that. But anyway, yeah, there is that, oh, it's liberation. Right. That was it. I felt so liberated, and I was liberated ever since then about so many things. That was really an important moment for me.
Words have power. And if you want to talk about a concept, it's much easier to talk about a concept by having a handle, a simple catchphrase or word to refer to that idea, so that you don't have to say whole paragraphs every time you want to talk about it. And Jew is one of those words. White is one of those words. And of course, our enemies don't want us to use words like that that facilitate us being able to pursue our own interests.
Yeah, and to be liberated. I mean, it just goes to show that they want us in a prison. We're prisoners.
Well,
we're not free.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, we're running out of time, as it always happens in this show. We have so much to start with. And I want to go to this article that you brought to my attention today about Canada and British Columbia and its Asian future, the growth of Chinese immigrants into British Columbia, and how, let's see, what was that number here?
Well, there's the title, Canada Prepares for an Asian Future.
Oh, yeah, and here it is. It's under the picture. 1 in 5 of Vancouver's population is Chinese. That's a lot. Yeah. 1 in 5.
Well, and it's really the trend, too, that they're talking about here in this article, because it may be 1 in 5 now, but it's only growing. And that's the future that's anticipated for Canada.
Well, right. So this falls under the heading sort of how we are being displaced in our homelands, and it's coming up everywhere. And the Chinese now are becoming really serious displacers. You know, there's more and more Chinese, more and more Asians, and so many people don't mind. Of course, when you have that many, but so many people feel differently about Asians, North Asians, as they do feel differently about Jews, a lot of people, than they do about blacks or the mestizo Latinos or other more people from more third world countries. It wasn't so long ago China was third world, but it sure changed fast, didn't it?
Yes, it has, and some people are saying that the trend will reverse itself because of that, because they're becoming more economically prosperous. The Chinese will move back, but it's not about what's best for the Chinese. It's about I would think from the Canadians' point of view, what's best for the Canadians. And less than 100 years ago, they were changing their immigration laws because they saw this article even talks about it. They didn't want to become Asian. They didn't want an Asian future. And even as recently as World War II, Canadians went off and died on the other side of the globe to make sure that their country wouldn't turn Japanese, that if they wouldn't be governed by the Japanese. And likewise for Americans. And that's what they were fighting against. And here we are 70 years later, and suddenly it's something to be celebrated. It's something inevitable. And we're, you know, God forbid anybody were to say, hey, I don't like this future that you're planning for us. I want to prevent it. That's unthinkable at this point, or at least unpublishable, unprintable.
They present it as financially beneficial. They're always talking about the trade. They're always talking about how well British Columbia is doing because of all this. They're close to China. They're on the Pacific Rim. And so they're benefiting from all this increased trade and from the prosperity that's going on there. So this is what they've always used. This is supposed to make it something that we would desire. And they talk about dumb things like how you can get these new flavors of ice cream, green tea, durian, and lychee. You know, I have nothing against the Chinese or their culture. I think they have a good, interesting culture and a lot of wonderful things. But that doesn't mean that we want our that we want to have our white, our beautiful white property like British Columbia is taken over by these people.
No,
you know, ourselves. What where are we going to live?
It's insane. I think by the literal definition of that word, it's what person would plan their own demise like that. You know, decades ago, it was Enoch Powell who his phrase was talking about England, that it's like watching a nation busily engaged in heaping up its own funeral pyre to see these people looking at a future in which Canadians don't exist anymore, really. And they're replaced by Asians and who knows what else from everywhere else. And it's not going to matter then what kind of foreign food you can get. I mean, that's just a short-term way of looking at it, of sort of making the best of the situation, of rationalizing what's happening and accommodating it. It's an excuse, and as the material excuse is, the materialism of this makes us wealthier. I don't think that immigration does make most people wealthier. It makes certain people wealthier. But it doesn't make everybody wealthier. It doesn't improve things. But that's why, you know, having control of the media is so important to the people who want this, is because they can say that it's wonderful. They can invert the reality and spout nonsense like diversity is our greatest strength. Well, if diversity is our greatest strength, why would you want an Asian future, right? If it's going to be pure Asians taking over Vancouver, isn't that a bad thing? Well, except until you understand that diversity is just a code word that they use. It just means less white people. It doesn't mean actual diversity in the literal sense of that word. It means less white people. So in that sense, Vancouver is becoming more diverse. As it becomes more and more Asian, it becomes more and more diverse.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there's this fellow here. He's got a name similar to yours, only his name is Tam with an M. that's Thomas Tam. You know, he's one of these up and comers. And I didn't even look to see what he's probably with a university or something. But anyway, he's promoting this and saying how this is a changing societies need to be looked at as opportunities, and all the white people need to. The whites need to look at the opportunities they can find in this melding of the whites and the Chinese and this part of the world and so on. But, you know, it's only this is a very libertarian point of view. This is only good for the people who can some kind of entrepreneurial skills or can take advantage of it or are highly educated or so on. That they don't mind, I guess, although some of them mind because they talk here about a neighborhood that was a very high scale neighborhood that was suddenly has a whole lot of Chinese buying up all properties, and they're transforming the homes. They're tearing down perfectly nice old homes and trees too to build these huge monster houses, they call them, because they've got so much money. And the people who are used to the traditional look of these communities, one is Shaughnessy and the other is Carisdale, they name them, are not at all happy about what they're doing. So they're changing the character, and they do change the character.
And the people who are there are unhappy about it. The thing to keep in mind, very simple thing, when you hear a diversity saying diversity is our greatest strength, they're not lying. They're telling the truth. From a diversity's point of view, diversity is their greatest strength. But that doesn't mean that we have to go along with that nonsense and pretend like it's our greatest strength either. It's not, and that's exactly the point of view we have to have, is what does it mean for us? And, you know, of course, the first criticism that you'll get beyond that you're some sort of troublemaker, hater, whatever, is, you know, somebody encouraging you to think about everybody. You know, we have to think about everybody, and this is the pitfall of liberalism. This is white liberalism. The assumption is that it's white people's responsibility to make a society which is inclusive to everybody. And it's that one society with one set of rules and one set of laws for everybody. Now, right here in the article, this fellow that you mentioned, Tam, it talks about who he is. He's the CEO of Success, an immigrant service based in Vancouver's historic Chinatown. Well, in one sentence there's two signs that this guy doesn't conform to the white liberal imaginary world. He's an immigrant activist, an Asian immigrant activist, and he lives in a place called Chinatown, where those Asian activists and Asians have naturally collected amongst their own kind. And they're, yeah, I'm sure, are very happy for Vancouver's Asian future, and Canada at large's Asian future. Why are they happy? Aren't we all the same? Why should they be happy that there's four Asians? Well, it's clear, because, you know, that's a bunch of nonsense. This idea of liberalism is nothing really but a trick to keep white people focused on everybody's interests, including non-whites' interests, including people like this guy Tam, who doesn't care about white people at all and doesn't care about society in general at all. He cares about Asian people. He works actively. He's employed. Right. His life is dedicated to furthering the interests of his own people. And this is the big problem I have with liberalism and liberals is, you know, people who believe this nonsense, this fantasy of theirs in their head, instead of getting upset with people like this Tam guy or the Jew firsters or the Latino firsters or whoever that is violating their liberal rules, who do they get upset with? Other white people. I'm sure that, you know, they'd rather criticize us for being racist, which means, you know, looking out for the interests of white people first or only, and rather than getting upset with these people who are looking out for the interests of their own.
What we really need is for those whites in Vancouver who didn't want those Chinese coming into their neighborhood to stand up and say, we don't want you here. However, there's laws now.
Yeah.
In the United States and, of course, in Canada, where you can't do that. And so if the realtors want to say, if somebody wants to buy a house that's for sale, it has to be sold. And so these people can kind of conspire to say, well, let's all go buy houses in that neighborhood, you know, yeah, or they just naturally follow one another there. So, if the people had the courage to stand up and say, we don't want you in our neighborhood, you know, they wouldn't get anywhere, and they'd have lawsuits against them, I guess. So this exactly can be really tricky.
It's not all in their mind. It's not that they're just cowardly. There are real consequences. If they were to stand up and say, no, I don't want you in my neighborhood, or if they were to treat those people rudely, or God forbid, vandalize their businesses or their homes, you can be sure that the Canadian authorities would expend every effort to find those people that were doing that and put them behind bars for long periods of time. And white people understand this, and that's why they go along. They sort of give up and would rather move somewhere else. That's the only or the easiest route open to us at the time is this white flight.
Yeah, but we're flying. We're being sent away from our good places. I mean, this is our good living places. Well, you know, we have talked ourselves. I wanted to go on to another story, but I can't ignore that we have left ourselves here with a quandary, sort of a dilemma, that we talk about how as whites we need to stand up. Oh, I was saying that. But then we see the legal restraints that have been set up, and there's more coming all the time. So really, when we talk about what can we do, I'm always getting back to that, what can we do? It's difficult. I don't know if I'm asking what can we do. I was trying to say white people need to understand what they're up against, but when we do understand, then what?
Yeah. Well, there's always a way to resist, and we are creative people, and we will innovate as we need to innovate. And I'm optimistic about that, that aspect of it, that we will do what we need to do. Once you realize what's going on, I think ignorance is a big part of it, that people are just not aware of. It's not that they're not aware of the whole problem, it's that they're not aware of how the pieces are connected to each other. And there are many
symptoms. Well, that brings us back to where I started, kind of. I'm happy about that, the creativity part. Yes. You know, we have the creativity, and if you can have a clear idea of what you want, you can always get there. That's probably what we're lacking, is this clear idea of what we want, because too many of our people, even those who are on our side, still feel in some way that we don't have a right to it, maybe, or still hesitant to claim what is ours and say this is ours and you can't take it away from us anymore. You think so?
I think a lot of them are afraid to discriminate, and they're afraid to exclude. They're afraid that they'll be excluded. I mean, the assumption when I came out and admitted or disclosed, you know, that my wife's father was Jewish, I was struck by the people who assumed that meant that I should be working against a white ethnostate and against white nationalism. That's just the presumption, is that it's this Niemöller idea of, you know, first they came for the X's and then I said nothing, and then they came for the Y's and I said nothing, and then they came for me and nobody could, you know, it's just this is a Jewish idea. And he wasn't a Jew, but of course it got promoted because this is what the Jews want everybody to believe. And people are afraid to discriminate. They're afraid to notice differences, and they're afraid to exclude. But they need to
find out. It's only us that are afraid of that.
Only white people are afraid to exclude him. And they're not afraid to exclude people like us. They're not afraid to identify us as the other and as the haters and mm-hmm. say whatever and do whatever nasty things they want to do to us. So, you know, I say tit for tat in that case. Makes me think, hey, there's nothing wrong with discrimination. There's nothing wrong with exclusion. It's just a matter of who's discriminating against who and who's excluding who. And you couldn't be much more polite than to just say, look, I don't want to be ruled by you, and you have no right to rule over me, and I'm going to resist you trying to rule over me. And, you know, the first attitude is, well, I'm not ruling you. I don't rule you in any way. You're just imagining things. You're crazy. But that's put to the lie by the fact that they want to shut you down. They want to shut you up. So, yeah, they are trying to rule you. And the Jews have a very infuriating way of doing it, too, this back-asswards way of basically, you know, they attack you by pretending that they're defending themselves, by ignoring their own aggression against you. I mean, I wouldn't have a problem with Jews if it wasn't for the fact that they were doing all of these nasty things. And that's what I criticize, these nasty things that they're doing. But if you stand up and you say something critical of Jews, well, the next thing you know, you've got all sorts of Jews attacking you for anti-Semitism because you're just a horrible Jew hater. And it's mind-boggling just how they invert that, you know, that the righteousness there, that they're righteous in aggressively attacking you because they're just defending themselves and defending their people. Well, I think we could take a little lesson from that and do the same ourselves. We're defending our interests, and you know, if talking is too much for some people to take, I think that's very telling.
They know they're wrong. They know what they're doing, and so they're very super sensitive to people pointing it out. Just like using the word Jew. I mean, they're, you know, anytime it's like pointing out, you know, it's like anybody who's guilty imagines that somebody's finding out about them, you know. I guess trying to get people clearer and clearer and clearer about these issues and about our rights and what we need to do is worth something, and that's what we want to focus on here, to bring things into such a clarity that people aren't confused about it anymore, you know. That they're not easily, because we're being bullied all the time and we have everything directed against us. So it takes a lot of strength, but it's not just strength. It really is when you're really clear in your mind about who you are and what people are doing to you. And I'm so clear about how many terrible, can't even come up with the word, the monstrosities that have taken, that have been done to the German people. I'm so clear about that, that I, you know, I can get, now I'm going to end with talking about anger. This will probably fit in. I mean, our people should get angry. We should be angry. I really appreciate my anger. And anger invigorates and energizes you. If it's not the same as depression. If I let things depress me, well, real depression, you know, you become hopeless and you don't do anything. But getting angry, and so there's people who say, oh, don't be angry. Oh, I'm never angry. Oh, I don't let myself get angry. It doesn't feel good. It feels good to me, and I don't know what I'd do without being.
I think there is righteous anger, and it should be vented. And it's when you try to repress it that it can cause mental damage.
Yes.
And that's can be worse.
Okay. Well, I hope I'm mentally healthy. I'm sure that you are, Tan. And
no,
Tan,
I
want to thank you so much. We are at the end of our show tonight, our very first show. I hope, listeners, that you have enjoyed it, and I hope a lot of people will be listening to it in future days. And it will be posted and archived. And so this is the I'm signing off now. This is Carolyn Yeager. My guest was Tan Stoffel from the White Network. Good night. See you next week.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.